Hello and welcome to a podcast from the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. My name is Guy Melrose. Patients with asthma commonly present to urgent care with both acute exacerbations as well as requesting the regular medications which they have either run out of or left somewhere in the world when travelling. New Zealand has new asthma guidelines for adolescents and adults. But how do these new guidelines affect our practice in urgent care? So I would like to welcome to the podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care, Dr. James Fingleton, who is a respiratory physician down in Wellington. Down there, he runs the Severe Asthma Clinic, and he's also a researcher in asthma. He's the Director of the Asthma and COPD Programme for the Medical Research Institute of New Zealand, and he had a hand in the 2020 New Zealand Asthma Guidelines, which came out this year. And I've asked James to join us today to talk about these guidelines, but through the lens of urgent care and how it will affect our practice in the acute setting. So welcome to the podcast, James, and thank you for agreeing to talk to us.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to speak. It's really interesting to have a conversation about these guidelines because they're only any use if they're actually implemented. If they just sit on paper, they have no value.
Yeah, and I think most of us will have either seen the guidelines either via the website or BPAC did a thing on them. And I think you've done a webinar, which a number of our members will have seen, which has talked about them. And I think the thing from my perspective was just trying to get into the interface between general practice and urgent care, because we deal with the patients often when they have their acute flare, and the general practitioner and the respiratory physicians are managing the ongoing chronic care. But we have a responsibility to, first of all, interface with respect to the ongoing management of the patients who present to us. But we also have to pick up on the people who are maybe not being managed as ideally as they should be. And these guidelines are a significant change to how we've been doing things over the years. So I think that's a good place to start, is the guidelines themselves. How have they come about, and what was your involvement in them, and how long have they been in development?
Yeah, thank you. So this is the second iteration of the guidelines. The initial guidelines came out, I think it's 4 years ago now, I think it was 2016 they came out, and that's coming from a background of it was recognised that there wasn't a New Zealand localised guideline, and the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation took it on to produce a consensus guideline, and the aim was to build on the excellent work that's done from international guidelines, drawing in particular from the Global Initiative for Asthma Strategy Framework. And so the aim wasn't to completely recapitulate all the evidence synthesis, it was to take the evidence synthesis that had already been done and to look at how that applied to a New Zealand context and to produce a workable, easy to implement set of guidelines that represented best practice but also took account of the New Zealand situation. And there was always a plan to update them. But with the additional information on as needed budesonide formoterol and some of the changes in availability of other medications such as mepolizumab and omalizumab, it was felt it was time to update the guidelines. And in the meantime, I joined the scientific advisory board of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation. I've also been doing some research that overlaps with some of these areas. And so I was invited to join the guideline committee, which is how come I've been involved in this update. And alongside the major changes that we're talking about in terms of the recommendations, there's also a change in that they are now adolescent and adult guidelines, and the child guidelines no longer contain the guidance for adolescents. And that really reflects the fact that the evidence base for a lot of these recommendations goes from age 12 upwards. And so it was considered by both guideline writing groups that adolescents should sit within the adult guidelines because that's what the evidence base dictated.
Okay, so if we move on then to the acute presentation to an urgent care clinic of somebody who's a known asthmatic, presenting short of breath with wheeze. You've mentioned the budesonide formoterol preparations now is the preferred reliever. Is that correct? That's the medication we're meant to be using as a reliever.
That's correct. So using anti-inflammatory reliever therapy with an ICS formoterol containing inhaler is the preferred way of managing asthma now. And that means that over time, increasing numbers of patients will have formoterol containing inhalers that they can use as relievers. And when we're treating people with acute asthma, the first stage of treatment with acute asthma is allowing them to use their existing inhalers. And so those patients can use an ICS formoterol and containing reliever, which realistically in New Zealand is the only currently licensed version, is Symbicort. They'd be using one puff of their Symbicort as a reliever, and they can repeat that as needed. Now, when somebody is more severe and you're getting to the point where you'd be thinking about multiple puffs of a short-acting beta agonist virus spacer or moving to a nebulizer, there's a bit of a gap in the evidence in terms of at what point we have to make that transition. And so the general guidance we'd give is while you're happy for someone to use their own reliever, then they can use their own reliever, whether that be salbutamol or Symbicort or terbutaline. At the point at which you're stepping up their treatment above simple repeating using their own inhaler, that's the point at which you may need to go to salbutamol virus spacer or a nebulizer if they're life-threatening and unwell.
Okay, so if we've stepped it up a bit, got the patient under control, and then we are now discharging them back home, if they're already on Symbicort, we're going to presume that they've got a GP or they've got their chronic disease management plans in place. What are we advising those patients who are already on this from a discharge point of view? And then the follow-up to that would be the person who maybe isn't on Symbicort, who's one of those people who are managing just with a salbutamol inhaler that they use intermittently and not very effectively. What should we be considering discharging those people on?
Yeah. So if you have somebody who's already on Symbicort, then the main questions would be checking that they know how to use their inhaler, checking that they actually have it, because adherence and improper technique for all patients with asthma are major risk factors for having an exacerbation. So when someone's exacerbated, the first thing we need to think about is, have they actually picked up the script that's showing electronically? So have they actually been dispensed the medication, and do they know how to use the medication? Assuming that they have been dispensed and they know how to use it, you then want to check that they're actually using the Symbicort as their reliever, because there are plenty of people out there with Symbicort as a maintenance inhaler who haven't made the switch yet to using it as a reliever. So not all patients will realize they can use it as a reliever. And so not all of them will be using it as needed or as maintenance reliever therapy. So the main things will be to check that. Assuming that they are already using it as a reliever and they know how to use it, then the question is, were they taking it just as needed or were they taking it regularly? If somebody's had an exacerbation and they're using their medication appropriately, you might want to step them up. So there are three levels of treatment shown in the asthma guidelines. As needed treatment, one puff twice a day or two puffs twice a day plus as needed. And so if they were only on as needed, you might want to step them up to regular plus as needed. Or you might want to increase the number of puffs, but they could stay with the same Symbicort inhaler. It's just around checking that they know how to use it and whether they need to use it regularly. Whereas if they are simply on a short-acting beta agonist, which the most common would be on salbutamol, with no regular ICS, that is no longer recommended in the guidelines at all. So whilst maintenance ICS or maintenance ICS LABA plus salbutamol is an accepted but non-preferred way of treating asthma, there is no role now for short-acting beta agonists by themselves. And so although I understand in an urgent care setting you're often reluctant to change an existing treatment plan or you're careful about it, I think there is an opportunity when you have patients who are having an exacerbation who are on a treatment plan that's no longer appropriate. And I think there's actually an obligation as part of treatment of that acute episode to get them on an inhaled corticosteroid-containing inhaler. And the one we'd be most likely to recommend, because it is now our preferred way of treating things, is to put them on budesonide formoterol-containing inhaler, so to start them on Symbicort. If that's not considered acceptable by the patient because they're not willing to change from salbutamol or for some other reason, then it's imperative they are started on some form of inhaled corticosteroid-containing inhaler during the acute setting, because we know that lots of patients won't go for their follow-up visit with their regular GP. But I think more than that, we know that receiving regular inhaled corticosteroids during acute event is associated with better outcomes. And so even over the next day or two, these patients are better off receiving an inhaled corticosteroid than not. So I think we have an obligation now. Any patient that comes to urgent care or to ED or to hospital who is not on regular inhaled corticosteroids, we ought to be starting on an inhaled corticosteroid containing inhaler. And that would normally be Symbicort at the moment.
And in terms of discharging people on inhaled corticosteroids versus a short course of oral prednisone, when is that considered an option?
So often it's not either or, but it would be both, obviously. So we would definitely want to make sure that everybody's on an inhaled corticosteroid when they're going home. And then those people who are having a reasonably severe exacerbation or have had a fairly prolonged deterioration, you're likely to want to start an oral corticosteroid. So anybody who you've needed to use a nebulizer in, or anybody that you've needed multiple puffs of a beta agonist, that shows that they've got very poor control. They're having a significant moderate severe exacerbation, and those patients should have a short course of oral corticosteroids, usually 40 milligrams of prednisone for 5 days. So I think anyone who's having a reasonably severe exacerbation should be started on oral corticosteroids alongside their inhaled corticosteroids.
So really, we're at a point now where if we've treated somebody with an acute asthma flare who is then stable enough to go home, they should be leaving with an inhaled corticosteroid and the education on how to use them. And that education is outlined in the asthma guidelines. You've mentioned from the Symbicort point of view, those three levels as needed, 1BD and 2BD. That should be for everybody. We should be recommending that.
Absolutely, yes. If you have somebody who is on a long-term treatment plan from their usual provider, they're receiving an inhaled corticosteroid-containing medication, whatever it might be, they're normally really well controlled, and they've had an acute viral infection that has led to a deterioration, you may consider that you don't need to change their underlying treatment. But for most patients, exacerbations come on top of less than optimal control. So if you have someone who's not well controlled at baseline, then it's perfectly reasonable to adjust their underlying treatment plan. And certainly anyone who's not on an inhaled corticosteroid must be on one by the time they leave.
And there's a table in the asthma guidelines, table 2, that outlines the definition of the levels of asthma control. So it helps you to determine how well somebody's asthma is being controlled. So that's what you would refer to try and guide that decision.
Yes, I would. And I would, it's well worth asking specific questions about daytime symptoms. Those four questions, you know, in terms of daytime symptoms, need reliever, activities and symptoms at night. And the reason I say that is because our perceptions of control and patients' perceptions of control, we know, are quite different. When somebody has partial or poor control, they may still say that their asthma is okay, because what they're often saying is it's not as bad as it is sometimes, but it can still be very poorly controlled. And so we can't just say, is your asthma normally okay, or is it normally well controlled? Because the patients will often say yes, but we need to explore what they mean by that. And often they are still significantly limited by their asthma, and we ought to be talking to them about the possibility of changing their treatment to try and get better control.
And there is a cohort of people who come to an urgent care clinic who are not unwell, but they're just coming in requesting medications. And often these will be people who are working away from home and have run out of their inhaler, or sometimes they've gone on holiday and they've left theirs at home. And it's quite common for somebody to come in and say, I just need a salbutamol inhaler. So these might be somebody who we're not necessarily treating them actively on the day, but we're going to be providing them with that thing that they're wanting. And from what you're saying now is that people shouldn't be just on a short-acting beta agonist like salbutamol. So do we step in at that point in those sorts of casual patients to say, try and get them onto Symbicort, or are we having to just educate them to then return to their GP to discuss that? What would be your thoughts on those sorts of casual patient?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. I would say that if they say that they normally just have a reliever and they aren't normally on any form of maintenance inhaler, then I don't think it would be appropriate to give them another salbutamol without looking to start them on a regular inhaled corticosteroid-containing inhaler. And depending on how the conversation goes with that patient, that may be interim maintenance ICS or ICS LABA, or it may be switching them to Symbicort, depending on what they want. If they say that they have a maintenance inhaler, that they've got enough of it, they just don't have enough of the salbutamol, then it's going to be a judgment call by the individual. You're going to want to try and satisfy yourself that they do actually have access to other inhalers. Obviously, you can't control what they take when they leave the building, and you're not going to want to refuse access to a reliever, but you should be trying very hard to discuss with them and satisfy yourself that they do have access to a maintenance inhaler, or if they don't have access to a maintenance inhaler, I would look to start one at that visit. And that's one where I would have a discussion with them about trying Symbicort. Now, the one thing I would say is some patients after 20 years using a blue puffer are slightly cautious about making the switch to Symbicort. So whilst I am very happy to have that conversation in an acute setting, sometimes you will meet resistance, and sometimes you may need to go for a compromise option of giving them access to some other form of maintenance steroid alongside their salbutamol and just planting the seed that they might want to switch. And often the way that we've approached this in the past is you start them on a butadesinide formoterol-containing maintenance inhaler and just mention to them that it also works as a reliever, and then they will over time be more open to switching to using that as their reliever, as they've already seen it be effective. So I think choosing a formoterol-containing maintenance can be a way of helping smooth the pathway to transitioning to anti-inflammatory reliever therapy.
And the benefits that this treatment brings to patients are significant enough that it's worth us trying to address these concerns with every patient, even though we will acknowledge that some will put up the wall and say, no, this is how I've done it, I'm not going to change, and it's a losing battle with those people.
Yes, I think so. And this is particularly the context of urgent care. Actually, it's almost a simpler decision in some ways about whether this conversation needs to happen, because by definition, you've got a patient in most circumstances who at the very least is poor control because they're needing more reliever, and usually is actually exacerbating. And therefore, this is a patient who needs optimization, usually. This is where the anti-inflammatory reliever therapy has particular benefits. We know that it reduces exacerbations across the spectrum of asthma severity in patients at risk of exacerbation, which anyone who's coming to see you in urgent care is pretty much by definition going to fulfill the category of being at risk of future exacerbations. So we know that those patients will benefit in terms of reduced exacerbation. As I say, it's particularly important, and the benefits are particularly dramatic for those people who are on beta agonists only, but there are benefits at all levels from switching to using a formoterol-containing reliever in terms of reduced exacerbation risk. It doesn't, across the board, change asthma control when compared to maintenance inhaled corticosteroid during ICS LABA. So it improves control against SABA only, and it improves exacerbations when compared to maintenance producer, I say a flabber. If you've got someone who is normally very, very well controlled, very stable, very happy with their existing regimen, and happens to have had an acute infection, then that is a situation where you may not choose to fight that battle as long as you're satisfied that they've got adequate access to inhaled corticosteroids via their normal maintenance regimen and they know how to use them. But in the majority of patients that are coming to urgent care, it's a conversation that's appropriate to have.
And as we're seeing patients probably just for the first and only time, and each time they come they see a different clinician or might go to a different clinic, those tables that I mentioned, there's table two, which is the definition of levels of recent asthma control, and then there's a table three in the guidelines which lists the clinical features associated with an increased risk of severe exacerbations. These are the things that are worth us going through at each occasion just to try and our role is almost to sieve the population for the people who are maybe falling through the cracks and not getting the optimal care. So these tables are useful to for us to use to try and weed out those people. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. And I would imagine that if you look at, for instance, table three, you know, the top, the first things listed as being associated with increased risk of death and severe exacerbation, poor symptom control, or having had an exacerbation or hospitalization or emergency department visit, or high subuse, which means three or more canisters in a year. Well, most people who are needing to come to urgent care for a repeat prescription or because they're having a worsening or an exacerbation are going to tick one of those boxes, let alone the rest of the list. And as you've highlighted, some of them will not be regularly presenting to their own GP. And so it may be the only opportunity we have to improve this patient's care before they pitch up to ED half dead in the future. Or unfortunately, we know that about half of asthma deaths occur before arriving at hospital. And so these are an at-risk group where we've got a window of opportunity to try and improve their care. And they're a group that are sometimes hard to reach through other mechanisms.
Yeah, I think we're all probably aware of the person who pops in just wanting the salbutamol script, or if they're asking for one, they'll say, oh, can I have a couple of repeats on there? And if they do that at different clinics and different EDs, and they could really rack up three canisters per year very, very quickly. And so it's important that we take the time to try and identify these people. Even though they're just with us for a very short period of time, we've got that opportunity to affect change. So I think we've certainly covered all of the things that I had on my list, James. Is there anything that you would want to add that we haven't covered that you think an urgent, an acute setting clinician needs to know?
I think I'd possibly, I might mention one thing that the guidelines don't talk about in great depth because it's sort of evolved more recently. I've certainly had a lot of questions around coronavirus and nebulizers and things like this. I imagine many of the people who listen to this podcast will already have moved to reduce their use of nebulizers and to preferentially use inhalers via a spacer. And I'd just encourage that as a very pragmatic way forward. Most people do not need a nebulizer. Most people who do need a bit of additional treatment, 4 to 6 puffs of short-acting beta-agonist one after another through a spacer is perfectly adequate and gives you equivalent benefit to a nebulizer. And therefore, that's a good way of trying to reduce the amount of aerosol-generating procedures that happen. And other than that, I just say, I think it's always a challenge when guidelines change, and it often concerns people. But I think we've got a real opportunity here to simultaneously simplify patients' treatment and try and improve outcomes. And I think it's an opportunity we need to embrace.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. I've certainly learned a lot from going through this and then from talking with you. So I hope everybody has benefited from this, and as you've mentioned, it is a change to a guideline. Sometimes feels quite jarring, and people can find it quite difficult. And before you know it, it becomes the norm. And I think we should, from an urgent care perspective, not look at these and think, well, this is maintenance management, it's more of a GP job. There is a large proportion of the population that we interact with who we can actually affect change in their asthma management by making sure that we are aware of these guidelines and act in their accordance. So thank you, James. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me to come on.
My thanks to James for talking to our podcast. Please do follow the links in the show notes to the asthma guidelines. And if you have any follow-up questions, email us at podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz and I will try and get them answered. If you're on Twitter, you can follow James at James Fingleton or the Asthma Foundation at Asthma Foundation, but without the first O in Foundation. I will also link to the BPAC pages which discuss the guidelines. Now we'll be back again next week with another podcast. I look forward to seeing you all then, but for now, thanks for listening.